Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the iPro Learning and Action Network Series Community-Based Care Transitions Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call may be recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Ms. Christine Stiegel. Ms. Stiegel, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, LaVita. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our Care Transition Statewide Learning and Action Network Educational Session. The purpose of the Learning and Action Network sessions, or LANs as we call them, is to highlight and share projects related to care transitions that have been or are currently being implemented in an effort to foster an environment of shared learning. We appreciate you joining us for this afternoon's teleconference call presentation. Those of you who registered for today's call were forwarded via email a copy of the presentation slides that will be referenced during today's presentation, as well as a summary that was provided by the presenter, along with the program evaluation. As a reminder, this conference call session is being recorded and will be posted to the iPro Care Transition website within the next 7 to 10 days to make it available for future review. As mentioned, all your lines are currently muted, but following the presentation, we'll be opening the lines for questions, comments, and further discussion. So with that, it's my pleasure to introduce Melissa Whalen. She represents the Finger Lakes region or community that has we give congratulations because they have been awarded a care transition-based program application through CMS. And Melissa brings over 20 years of healthcare experience to her work at the Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency. As an associate director of planning and research, Melissa coordinated and led a team this past January in submitting a community-wide grant proposal to the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Innovation as part of the Affordable Care Act's partnership for patients. The focus of this grant or funding opportunity is to reduce hospital readmissions and emergency department visits through supporting primary care redesign with a strong link to integrating home and community-based services. Melissa's accomplished interpersonal skills distinguish her as an effective leader, engaging and facilitating regional stakeholders in multifaceted system-wide quality improvement initiatives that promote implementing nationally approved evidence-based guidelines and local standards of care. Melissa's experience includes publishing and presenting at the European Association for Communication and Healthcare and the American Association for Communication and Healthcare and the annual Academy Health Research Meeting. Melissa's most recent qualitative research is scheduled to appear in the Journal of Academic Medicine, The Impact of a Program in Mindful Communication on Primary Care Physicians. And with that, I'd like to turn the teleconference over to Melissa so she can share what her community has been able to accomplish.
Thank you, Christine, and welcome, everyone. This is a great opportunity to share how we got to where we are now, and I'm hoping that it provides some insights to the work that you're doing, as well as can complete your network so that as you're working through some of your community challenges, you feel like you have some resources available to you. So I'd like to take the next half hour to 45 minutes to talk briefly about what it is that led to us applying and receiving the CMS award. I'd like to talk about some of the work that we were doing in the community prior to this that led to the community discussion about applying for the grant. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about what we think is important for your success if you were to apply to CMS. I think we've learned a lot over the last year and a half particularly, but more so I was able to participate in the first CMS Learning Collaborative that was conducted in Baltimore on March 19th. And it provided great insight as to what's important to CMS and what's driving a lot of the work that you're seeing, particularly the many RFPs that are coming out daily. So with that, I thought I would start. I'm going to go to slide 3, which is just a little bit of a background about Finger Lakes. We're an independent organization, and our goal is to bring a variety of community stakeholders together to talk about issues in healthcare and health that are important to the business leaders, the caregivers, which includes the community-based organizations as well as the medical providers, to take a look at trends in our region, which is a 6-county region, and together decide what is the most important priority to focus on and how do we work together collaboratively to address those issues. Going to slide 4. What started our work that led to this particular initiative is what we called the 2020 Commission on Health. This was a time where we had 4 hospitals that were applying to New York State Department of Health for Certificate of Need expansion. And at that time, we came together as a community and determined that instead of taking a look at the individual applications, we would batch the evaluations of the request for hospital expansions. So it shifted the focus from the individual project to determine the need of what was most important for an aggregate community need. We recognized at that time there was an unsustainable trend in growth driven by optimal care. And this was not only failure at one system, it was really failure of optimal care of us working together collaboratively as partners and as a healthcare system. So what we did, and this was about 4 years ago, the 2020 Commission determined that they would scale back the number of approvals for the Certificate of Need request, and that we would make a commitment to a community investment that would work to alter the trend by improving care in the community. And so basically what we did is we made a recommendation on the number of beds based on anticipated changes in the drivers of inpatient utilization. And this was realized through targeted demand management and reduction initiatives that ultimately we thought would reduce costs and also support operating expenses in the community. What we did is, on slide 5, we took the 2020 Performance Commission and identified that it was important to engage all of the stakeholders in the region. So as I had mentioned, this was hospitals, it was insurers, community-based organizations, businesses, and also many of the community active groups. So if you go to slide 6, this should look very familiar. This is the Wagner model that talks about how you take a community and you integrate it so that we're working with providers. And when I say providers, I'm defining that, again, as medical providers, social workers, behavioral health workers, community health workers, and integrating them with community services. But we're also talking about an organization where the insurers are working in partnership with the hospitals, with businesses, and with the providers. And ultimately, our number one goal is to create a well-informed, activated patient so that we're looking at population health, we're looking at the experience of care, as well as looking at the per capita cost of care. So ultimately, after the 2020 came together and made a recommendation to reduce the number of beds that were asked for in total and to invest in the community, What we did is we made ourselves some goals as a community, and we determined that we needed to impact the number of low acuity or non-urgent visits to emergency rooms, address the number of admissions for ambulatory sensitive conditions, or PQIs, as well as take a look at the number of low acuity admissions that were migrating from the rural or regional hospitals to Monroe County. And so what they did is the 2020 Commission set some very laudable goals, and this was based on the trends and the data that we had reviewed over a period of 6 years, and ultimately decided that we wanted to reduce ED visits by 15%, the avoidable ED visits, and decrease the PQI conditions by 25%. And from that, what we did is we really tried to employ the dimensions of value that, again, should look very familiar to many of you on slide 8. And that talks about the population health, the experience of care, and per capita cost, as I spoke of. Going to slide 9, again, these are the goals that we set as a community, and we determined that we would give ourselves 5 years to have this happen. So this happened in 2009 that we decided we would work toward a goal by 2014. And the whole purpose of this was to make sure that we had the right care available at the right time in the right place to meet the needs of our patients. In order to get to this place, we decided to develop a 2020 performance commission that would review literature, evidence-based research, and determine what initiatives we as a community needed to integrate and develop in working collaboratively. So if you go to slide 10, you'll see that we looked at what was the top conditions for our PQI admissions. And ultimately, it's pretty consistent with what I'm sure many of you are finding and we've seen around the country. The trends in respiratory conditions, heart conditions, diabetes are clearly the drivers of our PQI admissions. And so ultimately, we knew that these were the conditions we would want to target in our implementation efforts. Then what we did is we looked at some of the driving factors. So we wanted to take a look at slide 11 at what was the insurance status, what type of impact were we going to make based on the coverage of our residents in our area. And then on slide 12, you can see that we have a map. And again, this is the avoidable admissions and geography associated with those admissions in the 6-county region. We wanted to highlight those zip codes that demonstrated we had higher PQI admissions or ED visits. On slide 13, we took a look at the ED visits, and we took a look at how race and ethnicity might impact these trends. And on slide 14, again, socioeconomic status. So we tried to take a full view picture of what were the drivers in our 6-county region. And ultimately, on slide 15, we reached some conclusions. Again, nothing different than what I'm sure most of you are seeing. The respiratory and circulatory conditions were most prevalent for all PQI admissions in our area. Many of the discharges were PQI discharges. And then we associated the number of beds in the region that were filled by patients that could have potentially been avoided by even having to go into the hospital. And this was part of our projection when we made our recommendation for the certificate of need. Ultimately, everyone's most interested in how these charges are going to equate to an ROI, and so at the end, you can see that last bullet. It was about 10% of hospital charges for the PQI admissions were the drivers. We also wanted to share with our Performance Commission some of the conclusions we were finding nationally. And so what we did is we took a look at what was happening locally on page 16, And then we also shared what was happening nationally so that we could start to regionalize the learning and see what was happening in the nation, and also take a look at what was happening in our own area to drive some of our implementation efforts. And ultimately, we really recognized that rehospitalization or readmissions was the first step in addressing PQI admissions. And then having a primary care practitioner, seeing that practitioner soon after discharge, and having a team to coordinate the care was a strong link that in every intervention, regardless of what we looked at, that was a very common theme that emerged. So from that, I'm going to slide 19. I want to talk a little bit about what led us to the care transitions intervention. After looking at our data trends, reviewing what was happening nationally, and seeing what was best practices among many communities, it was very clear that Eric Coleman's care transition model was emerging. We were particularly impressed with this because it really emphasized the need for patient engagement and patient activation. And that was something that our community felt strongly about. And as many of you may know, his success demonstrated a 20 to 40% reduction in hospital readmissions. Ultimately, we felt that this was a great beginning to the community becoming together as an organization and collaborating in Wagner's model of treating chronic care conditions. So what we did is we phased our approach over the last year and a half. On page 20, this is one of my most exciting slides to share with you. We were incredibly, incredibly excited to learn that our local insurers, two major insurers, Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield and MVP, were willing to cover the cost of services for our commercial and our Medicare Advantage patients. Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield invited Eric Coleman to Rochester in the fall of 2010 and invited the community to participate in a community discussion about the intervention to help determine if this was something that we as a community wanted to work together and organize. And so ultimately what happened was Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield led the way and really pioneered Eric coming to the community, sharing his insights, and us having the conversation afterward to say, we're committed as a community to this program. Let's work together and figure out how to make it work. So we modified Eric's program a little bit in that it's not a closed system. We have actively engaged five hospitals and two of our insurers, as well as home care agencies and community-based organizations, so that we could pilot this to see what would happen with the commercial and Medicare Advantage population. At the same time, we also included the Medicaid HMO through Monroe Plan, and that allowed us to take a look at different populations and how this model would work. Again, because it isn't a closed system, what that meant was that we as a community needed to work together on identifying eligible patients, which meant we had to determine eligibility criteria. We also had to talk a lot amongst ourselves about sharing patient information. If a patient were to be discharged from the hospital and go into the community, how would that patient information be shared amongst those that were touching this patient? So there was a lot of organization, as you can imagine, particularly with respect to tracking these patients and ultimately reporting them so that we could identify if we were making a difference and if there were significant outcomes. After we had been coaching for almost a year, We also applied to New York State Department of Health for a HEAL-19 grant. We were seeing early results that were favorable with coaching, and we wanted to expand the program so that we could work toward becoming an all-payer community-wide care transition program. So what we did is we shared our learnings and our initial results with New York State Department of Health and applied for HEAL funds to extend to provide coaching services for uninsured and Medicaid fee-for-service patients. What this meant is ultimately the only population that we wouldn't be able to coach and have reimbursed services for was the Medicare fee-for-service population. So you can imagine when CMS came out with the opportunity to work with a community agency, we were pretty excited to learn that we might be able to become an all-payer community care transition intervention community. On page 21, I just wanted to show you some of our initial results. These are a year ago. But what we did as a community is we spent 9 months working together to determine how we would actually evaluate, track, and report our findings. So, again, we have home care agencies that are partnering with the insurers, sharing data, and then we're having claims data verify what the home care agencies are self-reporting. So we started in October of 2010, and this was just 6 months' worth of data that we used when we were working toward applying for the HEAL-19 grant. And ultimately, what we found was we had a pretty good acceptance rate, about 62%, and we also had a pretty high completion rate. The number that we were being readmitted to the hospital or the ED was not available a year ago because this was being reported from the insurers and we were getting this through insurer claims. So at that time, we didn't have any data. However, I'm pleased to share that just this past Monday evening, both insurers participated in our community 2020 Performance Commission meeting, and they shared some of their initial results and findings. Ultimately, MVP had produced a very detailed report that was very forthcoming to share that not only are they seeing a reduction in hospital readmissions in 30 days, but also at 60 and 90 days. And even more impressive is that we're seeing a reduction in ED visits. I think that this trend has been consistent since the beginning. What's most impressive to me is that we're seeing that there's a significant decrease in all-cause readmissions. And so while we're looking at tracking the PQIs, we're also noticing that there's a decrease in all-cause readmissions. And I think this is consistent with what Dr. Coleman was finding as well. So now I just want to switch to a little bit about our initiative here in our community when we went to CMS. If you'll recall, it's a community-based organization that needs to lead this effort. And ultimately, we very strongly need to link the home and community-based services after the patient is discharged. This was a very strong message that came from the CMS Learning Collaborative. Everyone is recognizing that we can't continue to work in the silos that we've had in the past. We feel very fortunate to have Lifespan in our community because they're an incredibly august organization that provides over 30 services for elders. And ultimately, they are an independent AOA-funded nonprofit in Rochester, and they have a good relationship with many of the organizations in our community. So they ultimately worked with us to schedule meetings with community members in the six-county region and talk about the opportunity to have the CMS grant if we were to write a submission and a proposal. And what we determined was last June, it's hard to believe it's almost a year ago, we had 60 people that came together and talked about what we were doing in our community and what our vision was, what it was we wanted to do. And ultimately, that vision is what led to us writing the CMS grant application that Lifespan is the lead AOA community-based organization. The home care agencies that were employing the coaches would continue to provide coaching services as they have already been doing in the hospitals, but expand the program to the Medicare fee-for-service population. We felt like we had learned a great deal of information over the last year and a half, and so we felt like we could quickly put this into implementation, which was clearly important to CMS. But as many of you may recall, there's also a component within the hospital that they're looking to have implemented in the care transition intervention as well. And so if you go to slide 22, you'll see some of the interventions that are working that the hospitals are working on right now currently. They already are identifying and tracking the reasons for their hospital readmissions, and they are performing a risk assessment stratification. So this provides a wonderful opportunity for the hospital to partner with the home care agencies in their risk stratification analysis and identify eligible patients based on our criteria. What's even more impressive is the hospitals are offering a variety of medication reconciliation opportunities for the patient. It could be upon admission that a pharmacist meets with the patient and reviews the medications that they are taking when they enter into the hospital. That pharmacist will work with the patient while they're in the hospital if, in fact, they have medication changes, which we know they frequently do. And also, the medication reconciliation will continue as a team huddle before the patient is discharged. So this allows continuity of that medication reconciliation throughout the hospital stay, which we know has been a big challenge for many of our communities. We have a provider checklist for our high-risk patients, so there's a criteria that the community uses as a standard to take a look at. And we're employing teachbacks, which helps us to identify what the patients are hearing at discharge, as well as what their families or caregiver supports are hearing as well. So we're looking for clarity of understanding, and we're looking for ways to support these patients when they're getting a lot of information at discharge at a time when they might not be feeling well and wondering what's going to be happening next. One of the things that we worked on in addition to our CTI intervention was employing a community standard for discharge planning. And what that means is the 10 area hospitals in our region agreed that there's four essential components for discharge planning. One of them, definitely medication reconciliation. So that's a nice continuity of care after a person is discharged. But what was more important was the patient family centrality, and that's really what borne the teachbacks. We also employed what the national standards have demonstrated are important, making sure that there's PCP follow-up in a timely manner. And so ultimately, again, this aligns with what Dr. Coleman recommends, that they get into that PCP office, and we're trying to make sure that that happens within 3 to 4 days post-discharge. Depending on the time of discharge, if it's a Friday night or a Saturday morning, we've given some leniency from the 72-hour recommendation from Dr. Coleman. The other thing is we've recognized in our community that certainly the skilled nursing facilities are addressing or impacting the readmissions. And so we wanted to make sure that we could support communication not only with the PCP practice, but also with the skilled nursing facilities. One of our hospitals is working to employ a hospital call center. And what that is the hospitalist in the hospital that's working with the patient, getting them ready for discharge, has a call center where they are reaching the PCP, and the hospitalist can have a conversation with the PCP. This was initiated because we found that many times the PCPs were not aware that their patient had been admitted to the hospital. And ultimately, if they got discharge notes, it might be after the fact that they've already seen the patient post-discharge. So the call center has provided a nice, timely continuity of care and allows for more appropriate follow-up for the care when they have that follow-up appointment. So I'm going to go to slide 23, which is our community-wide process. Basically, when we agreed to do CMS, we met in June, like I said. We had 60 regional representatives, and we talked about what we were doing and agreed on the scope of work. This was a difficult conversation because certainly everyone wanted to be involved in this, but we knew that we would not be able to begin the program in all six counties. We just didn't have the infrastructure support to make that happen. So what we agreed to do is build upon our previous work in the current counties that we're coaching, which is three counties. And we would clearly defined the work that was going to happen in the hospitals as well as afterward with coaching services. Again, the biggest thing for us was how are we going to track and report our processes? So we go to slide 24. And once we agreed that Lifespan would be the lead agency and the five hospitals would continue to partner with the home care agencies, we needed to take a look at the target population and define what our eligibility criteria was. This required us to take a deep dive into the data and really understand what the drivers of the PQI admissions were specific to each of the hospitals. Again, over a six-county geographic area in our region, we knew that we had some migration, and so the hospital demographics and needs would change with the patient. So we took data, SPARKS data, for each hospital and looked at the admitting diagnoses that ultimately were leading to the PQI's admissions in the ED visits. And this is how we came up with our list of our target population. Now, ultimately, this is a little bit different than what we had started with our pilot program with our insurers. That's because we learned that at the very last bullet, you'll see we've got special circumstances subject to interdisciplinary judgment. We've recognized that there are some patients that might not necessarily meet this criteria, but we've learned that they do very well with coaching. And so we've tried to allow the teams to exercise their judgment and professional skills and identify who's in need of these services and ultimately provide the services to that member. Slide 25 is something that I think resonated deeply with me after going to CMS Learning Collaborative in March. What we found to be our experience over the last year and a half is something that was emphasized strongly at the Learning Collaborative. You need to have leadership commitment. It has to be secure, and it has to be ongoing, so that ultimately, if the hospitals are working on readmissions and want to have an impact in partnering with whatever community-based organization, we needed to make sure that we had the leadership buy-in before we could do anything else. We were very lucky because we have two insurers that led the initiative for the care transition intervention a year and a half ago. So we've been working with this leadership for quite some time before the Coleman transition program came to our community. I spoke about our 2020 commission, and that commission is what really brought the stakeholders together to have the difficult conversations about how do we address the needs of our community. And ultimately, not everyone received what they ultimately wanted through the certificate of need, and they had to stay at the table to participate in the readmission reduction initiatives. Once we had that leadership commitment and buy-in, it made it a lot easier to form those multidisciplinary work groups because the leaders recognized the value of the program and working together and ultimately could designate people for work groups to inform and guide the intervention. The root cause analysis is something that is an invaluable tool that we find really helps the conversations when you get into some challenging conversations. When you've got the data in front of you, it's a wonderful tool that just demonstrates some objective information. And ultimately, you can decide as a group what you want to prioritize and what's most important. I think the number one thing that I really value with the agency partners that we work with is the process that's required to engage these stakeholders is something that's super important to us. We have core values as an organization that we operate within, and ultimately these are guiding principles. And so we think it's really important to establish trust right at the beginning, and that takes time. So transparency is something that helps, and again, I think this is where the data comes in. When you're able to share information and let people in the community know whatever we know about you, you're going to know about you, is really important. This is to help us inform our work and become better as a community, and it's not for any other reason. And once you've got the data that you can share together, ultimately, what happens is we've found the hospitals are coming together and initiating sharing their readmission data amongst themselves, unprompted, because they recognized that there was patient migration upon readmissions, and this was something that they wanted to address. Another thing that I think is really important is to identify where you might confront resistance or barriers. Again, if you can establish trust and you can operate with some guiding principles of honesty and transparency, I think that allows for honest conversations that, although might be difficult at times, ultimately we're trying to work toward what is the right thing on behalf of the entire community. And so you can expect there's going to be times where you're going to encounter resistance or barriers, and when you can anticipate that, it helps you to address it in advance. Ultimately, the most important thing certainly is to develop a measurement plan. What is it that's going to demonstrate is your program making a difference? That's something that's really important to our 2020 Performance Commission. We have targets. They're asking us for dashboard indicators to say, give us a directional indication. Is there anything you can share with us that says you're making a difference? What's the impact? Even if you're not making a difference, what are you doing to address it? Again, the data is just a very valuable tool. Ultimately, for us, I think our commitment to continuous quality improvement is something that, again, is reinforced through CMS. They've asked us to put plans into action very quickly, to use the IHI rapid cycle intervention that allows you to quickly make changes based on results that you're seeing. And so that this isn't something that's going to be studied. It's not a research project. They're saying you need to decide as a community what you're going to do, implement it, and once you start doing it, figure out what's working, what's not working, and take measures to address what's not so that you're continuously learning and modifying and improving it. And I have as the last bullet, go for it. I couldn't say strongly enough. It was wonderful to participate in March in Baltimore with 20 other awards through CMS, and they are incredibly flexible in identifying once you know your root cause analysis and you've got a sense of what you need to do, do it. Don't wait. Put your plan into action. Make it happen. Start now. If you research it and you take too long, we're going to lose this wonderful window of opportunity. Okay, I'm going to slide 26. And again, this was talking about establishing and maintaining trust. I think I've already gone back through this, except perhaps the last bullet, which is to provide a feedback loop. I think for us, one of the most important things we learned through coaching over the year and a half is that feedback is absolutely essential to the people that are doing the work, including the coaches, the trainers that are training the coaches, the people that are actively involved in collecting data and reporting data, and ultimately any oversight group. They want to have that feedback. And so we have a learning collaborative that we conduct locally every other month for our coaches. And the coaches have come together in a safe environment to share some of their skill development, but also to share some of the barriers they're encountering or some of their concerns. As you can imagine, in working with some of these complex patients, it can elicit a lot of thoughts and emotion among the coach who might want to initiate helping the patient to fix, but ultimately that's not what coaching is about. It's about empowering the patient. And when there's emotion that they're managing within themselves, how are they best coaching the patient? This is the place where we can talk about that. We can talk about how to improve acceptance rate, or how do you improve completion rate? What are strategies that are working for some that others might want to employ? So this was a great feedback loop for the coaches. The other thing that's worked really well is in our evaluation and specification work group. This is based on our data and reporting. We are touching these work groups very regularly. Every 4 to 6 weeks, we're coming together. We're talking about what are we receiving, what are we getting, what are the gaps, what are the barriers, defining what our community agrees to as a completion might be different from another community. Dr. Coleman identifies acceptance as the patient accepting in the hospital. We in our community determined that our acceptance rate would be determined based on if the coach actually completed a home visit. We call the hospital a pseudo-acceptance because we wondered if the patient was accepting just to get the coach out of the hospital room. And so ultimately, while they might be attentive at that moment, having someone come into their home, it creates a completely different paradigm. And we wanted to know if there was a difference. We found that certainly that initial acceptance and then the home visit, there is a number of people that do not complete. And so we looked at that through our data. And again, the learning collaborative and the evaluation work group worked together to find strategies to address that. Okay, I don't know how long I've been talking, but I'm wondering if maybe this is a good time to take a break and see if there's specific questions that folks on the call have or if there's additional insights that maybe I can impart.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question at this time, please press the star, then one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star, then one key. One moment, please.
Thank you, Lavita. Melissa, while we're waiting for questions to key up, I was wondering if you would go over a little bit more about how the organizations did their root cause analysis and how they incorporated maybe the patient's experience in that endeavor.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Finger Lakes actually performed the root cause analysis for the hospitals. Now, while I'm sure the hospitals also looked at their own data, we have the hospital SPARKS data that allowed us to take a look at what was happening within each of the systems. So we took a couple of weeks while we were writing and planning for the grant submission, and we developed data for each of the hospitals, met with them, reviewed numbers with them so that we could estimate what ultimately we would expect if we were to address the Medicare fee-for-service population.
Was Lifespan involved with that at all?
Lifespan did not participate in the root cause analysis, but Lifespan was integral in the design and the writing. And ultimately, what was nice about Lifespan was they have something called PeerPlace, which is a very robust computer network system that allows us to be able to identify a patient that is in the hospital, eligible for services, and ultimately may be connected to additional home and community-based services. This really provides a thorough, complete picture of what the patient is receiving and also helps us to identify if there's any type of gaps in care that need to be addressed.
Thank you.
We do have a question from Kim Swire.
I have a two-part question, the first of which is, in your coaching program, is there a time frame within which the patient remains active in the program? Mm-hmm. And then two, what disciplines are you using to act as coaches?
Sure. Great questions, Kim. So I'll start with the first. Is there a time frame that the patient is engaged in coaching services? We thought it was pretty important to try to maintain model fidelity as much as we possibly could. So Dr. Coleman's care transition intervention spans for 30 days, and that covers the initial visit in the hospital, a home visit post-discharge, and 3 follow-up calls. Now, I can tell you that some of our home care agencies have modified this if they're working with different populations that they believe may need additional support. So, for example, our Medicaid population, if they feel that they need to receive a second home visit or if they need to receive a 4th follow-up phone call, all of that will happen within 30 days, but it is focused predominantly on 30 days. The disciplines that we're using for coaches are social workers, registered nurses, educators. I think we have a hospice nurse. We actually have 21 trained facilitators in our community, and we have 2 trained the trainers. And honestly, I think that community health skills, facilitation skills, nursing skills, social work skills all play a role in facilitating the conversation with the patient to help support them, their empowerment.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star, then 1 key.
Hi, Melissa. Another question. This is Chris. I just wanted to, if you could expand a little bit more on the type of intervention you're doing with the skilled nursing facilities.
Sure. So we are not working directly with the skilled nursing facilities other than the communication transfer after discharge. Now, I can tell you that there is an initiative that's happening in our regional hospitals, and it is a consortium of nursing homes in the regional hospitals that are coming together, and they are employing a Lean Six Sigma approach to identifying reasons for hospital readmissions. Once they're going through that process and identifying reasons, they're identifying possible solutions that they can employ to reduce the readmissions. So much of our work is starting to integrate, again, with what's happening around the community so that we can join together and share information and also learn how to coordinate and integrate our efforts. In June, we have a work group meeting with the Greater Rochester Nursing Home Quality Consortium, and we will be sharing some of the interventions that they're employing, such as fall preventions, and what they're doing post-discharge after they receive communication that the patient is discharged to nursing facility.
As I was listening to you talk, Melissa, it's wonderful the way you started with a core group for the community, and now, although you've been working for 4 years, you are now bringing more organizations into the community, so to speak, or into the group to just enhance what you started. So.
Thank you, Chris. I will share with you, it was challenging for us to focus specifically on one core area and not spread and expand it too quickly, because certainly there is a need in all of the counties. In the pilot, we chose to remain very focused to learn as much as we could. And again, that was part of our interest with the CMS Care Transitions intervention, because it allowed us to spread and expand it in somewhat of a controlled way. But our goal by 2014 is to be expanding into all of our regions. And certainly that's going to mean that we're going to have to modify some of what we're doing, because we know the needs of our regional hospitals and patients are vastly different than what's happening right here in Monroe County.
You've really done a wonderful, you've provided a wonderful explanation of really the journey of your experience, which has been really great. And you've had some wonderful success, so that is, it's really remarkable.
Thank you. Something I learned at CMS that I'm not sure if people are aware of is there's something called hospital engagement networks. And this is relatively new. It started in the last couple of months. And we found out about the hospital engagement networks when we were in Baltimore. And ultimately, each of our participating hospitals are part of an engagement network. It might be a different network, but ultimately, the engagement networks are what we're calling incubators for a lot of the hospital readmission reduction efforts among hospitals. And it provides an opportunity for them to share and learn and inform each other about what they're doing and what's working. And we learned that CMS is asking the hospital engagement networks in May to become familiar with what the CMS award recipients are doing, so as to support that partnership and to ensure that there's consistency and a synergy among the work so that those silos are not created. That was very helpful for us. I think that there's going to be a national meeting in May that some of the CMS Care Transition awardees may present their initiatives at to help partner and spread the word about what's happening. If I could share a little bit about CMS, one of the things that was really helpful for me was to understand how the Affordable Care Act and the Partnership for Patients fit into this. And ultimately, what we learned is that there is an incredibly laudable goal on behalf of CMS, and that is by 2013, they are looking to reduce hospital readmission rates by, I want to say, 20%. And they've actually got a percentage that they've determined by initiative. And so what they shared with us is there's something through this grant award, the CMS Care Transitions Award, but there's other initiatives that are helping to support them meeting their targets. So, for example, some of the communities may have seen the CMMI RFP. There's, I think, three or four other interventions that are being provided and offered through CMS to help them make their targets. I think one of them is I think it's called the QIO ICP AIM. Again, there's the HENS, there's CMMI, and through CMMI, they're looking to integrate nursing homes as well. So I think CMS is recognizing that we have to collaborate, we have to partner, we have to work together if we really want to make a difference. And I think a lot of that came from Don Berwick's great work. He made a very strong impact on the people that we worked with in Baltimore.
We do have a question from Kathy Rohn.
This led to the readmissions. Because you said you did it for each of the different hospitals separately.
Hi, Kathy. This is Melissa. I'm sorry, I only got part of your question. Can you ask that again?
Certainly. Thank you. I was wondering what some of the factors you found as part of your root cause analysis led to the readmissions, because you said you did it for each of the different facilities separately.
Right. So each of the facilities, we took a look at what their specific admissions and readmissions were. And basically, they were all pretty consistent with the CAD, COPD, diabetes, hypertension. They all really did focus on the chronic care illnesses. In our community, we did not address, we had some exclusion criteria. So we did not address cancer. We are not addressing some of the mental health issues. And there was a third. I'm trying to think of what it was. I think it was substance abuse. We recognized that there were certain populations that would require much more intervention. And so if someone is an active substance abuser, as identified upon admission at the hospital, they did not meet the eligibility criteria.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
At this time, we're showing no further questions.
Well, I want to remind everybody that along with the presentation handout, we did provide an evaluation form. So please, we encourage you to fill out that form and fax it back to us, because we use those to as feedback to our presentations as well as in planning our future presentations. So if you could do that, that would be very helpful. And Melissa, I really thank you for providing a wonderful overview as well as highlighting some of the collaborative effort that CMS is trying to, actually achieving through the hospital engagement networks, as well as us as the QIO and the different community partners throughout with Finger Lakes, but also throughout New York State, so and the nation in the Partnership for Patients initiative. So that is, thank you for mentioning that.
Thank you, Christine. I'm really glad that we had an opportunity to share after I went to Baltimore, and I hope this was helpful to those who are interested in submitting a grant application.
Sure, and Melissa's contact information was provided in the presentation, so I'm sure that you won't mind if there's other questions that people would contact you.
No, not at all. I welcome the opportunity.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate you sharing, and have a nice afternoon.
Thank you, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.